It's okay. You have a minute. You can take it.
I'm sure she wants to wish you luck.
Tatum turns to me and offers a lopsided smile, which reminds me of why she slayed me way back during the Romantica shoot, and then made it official when she kissed me, or I kissed her, on New Year's Eve.
I'm about to puke, so just thank her for me and I'll call her later, she says.
I stand, press the phone to my ear.
Mom, I have about 30 seconds. What's up?
I expect her to say, oh, just wanted to be the first to congratulate Tatum.
Or,
kiss your fabulous wife for me before she wins.
Instead, she shrieks, like I have heard her only once before in her life. And in an instant, it's 10 years ago. It's horror and death and the fallout that is destined to come.
It's Leo,
she yells.
My God, Ben, it's Leo.
I run up the aisle and out to the lobby, just as the lights flicker to return us to our seats. I miss Tatum's category. But then, nothing that happens after this moment matters. And I miss Tatum's speech, too. But later I'll learn that she forgot to thank me anyway.
12. Tatum. July 2004. My big break comes 15 months of slinging cosmos and sex on the beaches and Chardonnays for tourists at P.F. Chang's. I don't mind the work so much. It keeps me busy, though the children are often ill-behaved and whiny, and the tourists are loud and don't tip well. But Mariana, who logs most shifts with me, has become a good friend, and with Ben still working unending hours, this time prepping for One Day in Dallas, a Kennedy biopic set to shoot next spring, the stint gives me structure, fills my days with something other than scanning the trades for shitty auditions, staring at my cell phone in case my relatively dodgy agent calls, running on the beach to lose a few pounds, which will take me from girl next door to girl someone wants to fuck, in Hollywood terms. I'm contemplating adopting a dog for the companionship, but Ben isn't home often enough for me to get an affirmative. I might just do it without you, I said to him one night while he was nose-deep in a revision. You'll just come home to a strange animal in the kitchen.
I prefer strange animals in the bedroom, he said, and I laughed, so he pushed his luck and teased. See, I'm listening to you even when you think I'm not.
So a dog is a possibility, a positive on the potential horizon. Still, in the months that have passed between landing in L.A. and now, my ambition has gone from hopeful to desperate. My attitude has devolved from optimistic to jaded. There's a reason you see aspiring starlets hopping off the bus in movies full of sunshine that turn pale and gray as the scenes roll past. How many doors can one knock on before the rejection starts to sting? Ben tells me to keep my chin up, but Ben is working on his third feature, which I'm happy for, of course. It fills our bank account, offers us stability. His success makes him happier than ever, as if each chit, each accolade brings him closer to God, a self-anointed Hollywood God, but God all the same. He tells me sometimes that he's chasing the ghost of his dad, and I tell him that he now has to satisfy only himself, and he nods and sometimes seems to believe this, and sometimes he doesn't. I don't try to talk him out of it too much, though. I understand the weight of parental baggage. It's not as if I'm not heaving my own shit around, too. It's not as if I'm not wandering about trying to find my own way, too. What I'm trying to find is what I embraced at Tisch, and what I discovered as a senior in high school after my rocky earlier years, and after my dad was absent and my mom was present, but also on one of her holistic jags where she was more focused on the soothing nature of lavender or why we should ban dairy from our home than noticing that her teenage daughter was flailing about with a broken heart and a lost virginity and with no one around to guide her. At the time, I was taking drama because it fulfilled my arts requirement, and we were staging a modern rendition of Romeo and Juliet. Our teacher allowed us to adapt it for the modern era. Think more Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes than Shakespeare. And when he cast me as the lead, I had to read the call sheet 3 times because I was sure he'd gotten it wrong. He hadn't, and to my surprise, I held the audience rapt, silent, almost reverent. The school newspaper had given the production a mixed review, but handed me a rave. My mom, an amateur poet who never had loftier aspirations, attended the performance and wept afterward. "If you can dream it, you can be it, baby," she said on the drive home. "So why didn't you ever try to get published?" "The art is sometimes enough," she said, squinting against the headlights of an oncoming car. "The art sometimes just has to be enough." But the art wasn't just enough for me. I knew that immediately when they dropped the curtain on Romeo and Juliet. I knew it all through college, through the slog of hailed shows with great performances, Hamlet, The Heidi Chronicles, and less successful shows with still great performances, The Importance of Being Earnest, and a particularly jarring Lost in Yonkers, where I was the only one who could pull off the accent. Daisy wasn't wrong back at my wedding. I probably had been the best one in our class at Tisch, but out here in L.A., Tish didn't mean much. Out here, big boobs and a small waist and, sometimes, a suggestive nod to a producer who may or may not want to undress you in his office after a meeting meant much more. Daisy moves out the weekend of July 4th and crashes in our spare bedroom in our small bungalow. Though it's theoretically Ben's office, he's gone so often that it's mostly empty space where I sometimes unroll my yoga mat or find an exercise show on TV and run through a series of squats and lunges that make me hate myself, or, when I'm feeling more generous, hate this town for making me care about the circumference of my thighs. Daisy is tiny and oozes all-American, so it's no shock that she has a slew of auditions at the ready. Also, Daisy is connected in ways that I'm not, in ways that Ben is. I try not to begrudge them this. Hollywood never promised to be a level playing field, but when her brother's friend casts at ABC, and when her dad's college roommate runs Paramount, it's hard not to feel the nick against my skin. I want to call my mother, want to complain about the inequity of it, not because it means I won't work hard, harder, but because sometimes the complaining is the solution in and of itself. But my mother is no longer here to listen. Sometimes I call Piper, but she's an obstetrics nurse, like my mom, who works nights and sleeps days, and I hate waking her with my burdens. Sometimes I'll complain to Leo, who himself calls more often, needier now that his own dad is gone, though I never had the impression that he dumped his inner life on his dad in the first place. But grief and death can do that to you, slice open a place that is vulnerable and wanting. So he leans on me like a big sister, and in return I lean on him, because he makes it easy to. He listens to my grievances about my humiliating auditions, or the way I collided with a waiter carrying a full plate of hot fried rice, and how even half a day later I found charred peas in my hair, and plenty down my bra, too, and also how I'm just a girl from Canton who can't call in favors. There's Ben, yes, who floated my name to casting with One Day in Dallas, but I wasn't the right type, as is too often the case out here. Leo may be a rich kid with a traitor job he hates, but he listens, and because he wants so desperately to shed the burdens of his own background, the job he loathes, the expectations of a dead father he can now never outrun, he understands. Now, Daisy has rented a convertible until she leases a car of her own, but insists that I drive. "I'm hopeless with maps," she says. "Besides, it will be more fun if you come." So 3 days after she lands in L.A., I chauffeur her from audition to audition. Daisy is naturally skinny, with just the right amount of curves, and she is very blonde, like she was bred on the farmlands of Kansas, a look that happens to be in high demand right now at castings. Well, really, it's always in high demand. She goes out for guest spots on 2 teen shows, a small read for Quentin Tarantino's newest, and more commercials than I've auditioned for all year. If it were anyone else, I'd hate her. Actually, it occurs to me as I sit in the car at an expired meter so I can argue with the meter maid if she circles around, that I do hate her a little bit. But she's Daisy, and one day, if asked, she'll drive me around to my own set of auditions. I try to meditate as I wait. I had attended a freebie class on the beach last week, run by a celeb guru. I was kind of hoping to meet someone famous who might decide to be my best friend and help me forge connections of my own, but also I thought maybe I'd learn something, too. To help me quiet my mind, to still my unfulfilled ambition. In the car, I breathe in and count to seven, then breathe out and count to seven over and over and over again. But then Daisy raps on my window, and my eyes fly open, and I'm as I was before. Listless, annoyed. Jealous, if I'm really being honest with myself. "You okay?" she asks, sliding on her seatbelt, undoing her rubber band so her hair spills effortlessly over her shoulders like in a shampoo commercial. "Yeah." I put on my blinker to head up Sepulveda to take the back roads toward the valley, hoping to beat traffic. "All good. All fine. Just tired." "Hey, I'm not getting any of these, you know that, right?" "Of course you are," I say, "and I want you to." "Well, I'm not. I mean, I've sucked it big all day." "You don't have to say that. You don't have to make me feel better." I fiddle with the dial on the radio. "I thought that you were fine." I sigh. "It's not you, it's me." "You were the best one of us at school, Tate. That doesn't matter out here." She quiets, losing herself to the view out the window. "Were you meditating just now?" I refuse to answer on the grounds it might incriminate me, I say. She chokes on her laugh. "What the fuck? You've been out here for like a year and you're meditating? Whatever happened to the fuck-all bartender from NYU I knew and loved?" "The fuck-all bartender was just an act, you know that. When have I ever been fuck-all anything in my life?" I come to a stop at a light. "Also, I took a class with Lily Marple's guru. And you know that she's nearly the highest-paid actress right now? I mean, it must be working." "I know someone who knows Lily Marple's agent. Said she'd give a blowjob to anyone who asks." "Shut up." She shrugs. "It's true." "Jesus, I'm so fucked." "No, dear, not that. Just a blowjob or two." She starts to giggle, which spirals into an uncontrollable fit of howling, crying laughter, and soon I'm laughing so hard I can barely keep the car in my lane. "Hello, Hollywood! Daisy is here and she is prepared to give blowjobs!" I scream out the open air of the convertible until I realize that we're actually in front of the audition building and I jolt into a parking spot. "I take that back!" I shout. "Daisy is here, and she is the most professional, qualified actress I know." Daisy reins in her laugh until it sputters to a slow chuckle, takes three deep breaths, and then flips open her compact mirror. Her eyeliner has smeared. Her cheeks are blotchy from the hysterics. "God, I look like hell. Also, I'm wiped. I don't think I can deal." "Come on, Daisy. Get out. Don't be late." "Can't. Don't make me." I put the car in park. "Daisy, seriously, this is for the OC. That's like real shit, real exposure. You can't be too tired for that." "I am. Jet lag." She groans, then tilts her head toward me and smiles. "Besides, I'll never get the part. It's for a bad girl with, like, tattoos, not the blonde all-American." "Well, they wanted to see you." "Oh, God, you know as well as I do that they have no idea what they want to see. And I'm pretty sure they only agreed to this because my dad made some calls." She shoves the sides, the audition dialogue, at me. "You go. Tell them you're me." "I can't tell them I'm you. I don't even have my headshots on me." Daisy pops open the glove compartment and pulls out a stack. "Please, if I know anything about Tatum Connolly, it's that she's always prepared. Sign in with my name, then give them your real stuff when you get in the room. They won't say no." "They'll say no." "Then so what? I'm not getting this part anyway." I glance at the sides. She's right. This role was practically written for me. Not me, Tatum, but the version of me I so easily inhabited at the bar. The one who threw shots down her throat, dismissed the tardy undergrads, picked up men for the sport of it. That version of me could play this role as if I were someone else entirely. "They're going to say no," I repeat. "So make them say yes," she answers, and shifts her seat back to take a nap, as if she's put the question to bed. They ask me to read 3 times through, then whisper among themselves, conferring in a tight little huddle behind a table littered with scattered headshots, discards of actors who are disposable and unwanted, not right for the part. The director, Seth, a guy about 30, give or take a few years, with a scraggly goatee and a worn Red Sox hat, flips my resume over and rereads it.
"So," he says.
"So," I reply.
"I could be blind here, but I'm pretty sure you are not Daisy Alexander, now are you?"
I stutter, feel my composure ebbing out of me. I remind myself to play the part, to be anyone they want me to be anyone I need to be. I tilt my chin higher, puff out my chest.
"Listen, I just thought..."
He waves a hand, indicating for me to be quiet. I turn to go.
"Wait, it's okay, it's okay."
His eyes narrow on my resume again.
"Ah, Romantica. I knew you from somewhere."
He smiles.
"Ben and I grew up together."
Ben grew up with everyone, it seems like.
"I know, right?"
He laughs.
"You from the city, too?"
He means, are you part of our circle? Shouldn't we have met? Are you someone from whom I should curry favor?
"Sort of," I say. "I'm intrigued," he says, raising an eyebrow.
"Give me the part and I'll tell you anything you want to know." His raucous laugh shocks his associates into laughing, too. I smile, though I think, you are all such fucking lemmings. I put my hand on my hip, jut it outward, flip my hair in a display of attitude. It's not so hard, this bravado. It's what I practiced for at the bar with Daisy. It's what I trained for practically since Romeo and Juliet. Being someone other than me. I slip into it like a second skin, like if I try a little harder, soon I won't even notice the difference.
"I like it," Seth says, nodding.
"Me too, I think." They call the next morning with an offer for a 3-episode arc. Tell me to have my agent reach out to go over the details. I only have my dubious commercial agent, with his dreary office in Van Nuys, who mostly got castings for non-union local commercials, and possibly softcore porn, so Daisy calls her own agent, and just like that, I have real representation, and I'm a working actress. Daisy had booked 2 of her commercials and got the spot in the Tarantino movie. The OC was small potatoes compared to that, but I didn't have a dad who knew people who knew people. I didn't have a high school network to call in favors. Not that Daisy wasn't talented. Not that Ben wasn't either. Also, not that I wasn't indebted to Daisy for giving me the audition in the first place. I was. I am. I love them both. But even with them in my army, it had been 15 months without as much as a nibble, without as much as a solitary yes. I was the most talented one at Tisch. Ben ditches the office early, and he, Daisy, Eric, his writing buddy from Williams, and I toast to our successes at Nobu off the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu as the sun blazes out into darkness, painting the sky in oranges and pinks and yellows that seem unimaginable if not for viewing them with our naked eyes. Ben snakes his arm around my waist and tugs me in for a kiss, while Daisy and Eric flirt over the bottle of champagne that Ben ordered, and we drink too quickly. "You didn't have to do all this for me," I say, waving my hand, still clutching a mostly empty flute of champagne. "It's just a guest part on the OC.
"It's the start of something. It's the beginning of a snowball."
He tilts forward and touches his forehead to mine. "So we can snowball together," I say.
"Let's snowball together," he repeats.
"Okay," I say.
"I see you,"
he whispers in my ear. I close my eyes and kiss him, because we see each other so easily, we can do so even with our eyes pressed shut.
13. Ben. May 2010. My mom has asked me to give a toast, which should be easy, which should be cake. I'm a writer, after all. Tatum leans over, kisses my cheek, adjusts my tie, and says, "Breathe." I rise with a flute of champagne held aloft, though if anyone were to look closely enough, they'd see a tiny tremor, a small betrayal of my feelings. I want to be happy for her new life. But I'm trapped in this bubble of melancholy, of what-ifs. What if he hadn't been on the plane that day? What if he'd been around to see my success? What if he'd been around to see that success falter? How would I be changed? How would I be unchanged, too? We've spent a month in New York for Tatum's shoot, so I've gotten to know Ron a bit better. Broken down some of my walls. We've gone to the movies, drunk wine, taken in a Yankees game. He even joined me for Joey's music class, which was filled with mothers and nannies and made a pretty funny wisecrack about our levels of estrogen rising just by crossing the threshold. He asked me about my work, if I'm relieved to be moving on from Alcatraz, the TV stint that Eric and I embarked on but that never really caught fire in the ratings. If I have anything new in the hopper. Ron told me how much he loved the new Reagan biography and that he knows my dad revered him, and recounted a story of how he once met him at a Hollywood party in the 70s. I was so far out of my element, Ron laughed. Not made for it like you and Tatum. This isn't true, that I'm made for it. And this assertion rankles me, even though ostensibly he's taking an interest, getting to know me. I'm not at all made for Hollywood the way that Tatum seems to be now. Her A-list Mommy and Me group, her trainer and chef who appear in our kitchen at 7 a.m., her newly hired assistant Stephanie to oversee all the details that she no longer has time for. I'm part of all this, true, but it's as if I'm standing on the outside of a glass door looking in. I can hear the clatter, but I'm 1 degree removed. We used to tell each other all the time that we could see the other. It was our code, our something private. But now I see her less and less. Not just literally because she has gone on set or on location, but metaphorically too. And not in how she is ambitious. I understand ambition. But in how she doesn't let me in like she once did. Or maybe it's that I don't try as hard to get entry, because there is so much other stuff. Her career, mine, Joey, miscommunications, exhaustion, grief, Walter, standing between us. What I've always loved the most about Tatum, her transparency, is slowly fading. I don't know how to get that back. I don't know what sort of work I have to put in to get that back, when she is the one who is always leaving. How do you tell your wife that you want her more to yourself, that you wished she worked less, without sounding like a jealous, emasculated asshole? I still want you to write something for me, she says from time to time. Just like she used to say before she had more offers piling in than she can handle. Before she could be choosy about awards bait and commercial success. Before beauty companies dangled lucrative contracts. Before People and Us Weekly and TMZ took an interest. I usually nod and say, I know. And yet I never start that script. The one just for her. Not because she wouldn't be luminous. To be clear, Tatum is luminous in everything, just read her reviews. But because I wonder if maybe I can no longer match her brilliance. Alcatraz getting canceled stings. Your wife recognizing that your talent isn't what she always believed it to be would go way past that. It would be decimating. Breathe, Tatum mouths to me at my mother's wedding to her new husband, our eyes locking as I weave to the front of the garden. Tatum called in a favor and reserved the private townhouse of Mitch Sterling, the producer on her new project, Fallen Manhattan, in which she saves Manhattan and the world from alien invasion. It's penned by Alan Frank, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, so her team thought it was a smart play. Turn on the teenage and young 20-something guys while still reaping critical acclaim. Mitch's townhouse is largely unoccupied, while he spends his time in L.A., so he happily opened it up to us for the occasion. My mom hadn't wanted much of it to do, but she'd wanted something. That we found each other through this tragedy is really something to be celebrated, she'd said. And it was. I bristle at Ron, but not because he is Ron. I bristle, as Tatum points out, when we argue about my distaste for her own father, because I have issues with paternal figures. That I have unresolved feelings toward my dad. It's textbook, Tatum says, and I'm sure it is. But that doesn't change the bitterness I swallow, mostly about Walter, but sometimes about Ron, too. Leo is sitting at the table with my new stepdad and his daughter, Veronica. Leo winks at me as I pass by, reaches out and squeezes my leg. Yo, bro. Love ya.
Daddy!
Joey shouts from his perch on Tatum's lap.
That's my daddy!
Everyone laughs and turns to gaze at him in his tiny Brooks Brothers suit, with his curly blonde hair that resembles neither mine nor Tatum's.
That's your daddy,
Tatum says, and everyone laughs again, not really because it's nearly as cute or funny as when Joey said it, but because people laugh and fawn when Tatum says just about anything these days. It's not her fault, I know this. It's simply inevitable. The way that fame shifts everyone else's perception of you while you've done nothing to ask for it. Been in a few good movies, locked in a few excellent performances. That's not nothing, but it's not everything either, in the way that fame can masquerade that it is. Tatum would say this too, but she'd tell you that the fame part of it, that's just someone else's expectations. It has nothing to do with her or the work or our day-to-day lives. Still, it's an amorphous mass, a cancerous blob that has taken root. And though she tries to ignore it, tries to pretend that nothing has changed, that her being asked for autographs in the airport on our way here, that her being comped a ridiculous bottle of wine when we snuck out to a small Italian joint around the corner, is all status quo. In truth, her fame has shifted nearly everything. Maybe everything is me being ungenerous. I hate this side of me. But like that cancerous blob, I don't know how to simply cut my pettiness out of me. Its toxicity is everywhere. Also, Tatum is so often not present that she hasn't felt the mass, hasn't noticed what's festering. Maybe that's what keeps it alive in me. That, like a child, I want her to give me attention, stand up and say, I still see you. Sometimes she does. I don't mean that she doesn't, and I know that I am 35 and no longer able to excuse juvenile behavior away.
It's textbook.
So why isn't there an easier fix? For me to find. For her to suggest. Therapy, sure. But I don't want to be one of those L.A. types who sits on a couch and moans about the inadequacies of his cushy life. I want my wife. I want to see my wife. I want her to see me. Then maybe I won't be so brittle. Maybe I won't be so easily broken. Tatum sees me today, though, meeting my eyes again, wishing me on. I clear my throat, gaze at my mom and Ron, who seems to wholly love her and whom she appears to love wholly in return. I'm not 8 or 10 or 12 years old. I know that he is not taking my dad's place. I know that my mom should be happy. My eyes move to Leo, and I wonder if this isn't a bit how he felt over this past decade, how I tried to be his father without him asking for it. It's different, of course. I'm his blood. I promised my dad I'd look out for him. But this notion that someone can be taken from you, disappear into a void in a matter of literal seconds, and then you have to live in the vacuum of that void, it hasn't gotten easier. So maybe that was why I tried to put my foot down with Leo, tried to guide him in the way that I thought my father would think best. Maybe that's why I'm pricklier with Ron, even when I know better. I raise my flute toward the open sky in the back of Mitch Sterling's garden, which has been lavished in yellow roses, my mother's favorites.
Love you,
Joey calls to me before I can start speaking. Love you too, buddy, I say back.
Love you,
Tatum mouths to me. Love you. I mouth back. Love you, Leo shouts, which makes everyone giggle again. Love you, I say sincerely back to him. Leo rises and wraps me in a hug, slapping my back, holding me for a beat longer than the pre-rehab Leo would have. He's been clean for almost a year now. He calls me on Sundays to check in. He is rededicated to his job. He left the nightclub business, and he never told my mom about any of it. His skin is shiny, his eyes well-rested, his muscles strong when my hands press against his shoulder blades on the other end of the embrace. It wasn't a seamless process, my tough love, my insistence that he finally grow up and grow a backbone and accept responsibility for the roads he'd put himself on. Tatum wanted to do it differently. And Walter, her dad, told me I was mistaken, that I needed to offer support, not just firmness. But here we are, and he is thriving, and Leo and I proved them wrong. I know I'm a writer, I begin, but that doesn't make me an expert in the ways of love. Bullshit, Leo calls out. You married Tatum Connolly, so you must be doing something right.
That's true,
Tatum shouts from a couple of tables behind him. Well, marrying my wife was the one smart thing I've done in the name of love my whole life. Though that just makes me lucky, that doesn't really make me smart. I don't know why I'm announcing this, my most neurotic insecurity, to the crowd of my mother's and new stepdad's friends. And I don't know when I started to think that this might be true. But it comes off as self-deprecating and everyone grins, then turns to gaze at my wife in the back of the room.
Don't sell yourself short,
Tatum calls out, playing to the audience, and everyone laughs. She says this a lot to me now.
Don't sell yourself short. Dream it, be it.
And I know she's not trying to be patronizing, but it is. It's fucking patronizing and demeaning, and even now I feel a red flare of anger rush through me. Like if she still saw me, she'd know that I don't need uplifting quips to get me back on track. She'd know that I'm already trying to ride my train. Okay, well, with that established, I say, I just want to say that I'm not necessarily wise in the ways of love. I don't know why our dad was taken from us, and Ron, I can't say why your wife was either. But I can only say, life sometimes grants us second chances, and if they should fall upon you, if you should be lucky enough to be offered another chance at happiness, then you'd be a fool not to seize it. I look at Leo, with his own second chance, and he nods, grateful. I look at my mom and Ron, who are genuinely overcome with emotion, her with tears on her cheeks, him wiping them away. And so, I'll ask all of you today to raise your glass to second chances. May we all be lucky enough in our lives to be granted the opportunity for love and joy and family. And when that opportunity presents itself, may we all be as smart as my mom and Ron, who refused to let life slay them when life sure as hell tried. Everyone raises their glasses. To second chances, they all say, as Ron leans close to my mom and kisses her. Tatum meets my eyes and blinks, our old code, our old signal. She still sees me now, like she used to, like we both used to. To second chances, I say again, telling myself I won't squander my own whenever the opportunity arises.
14. Tatum, March 2005. Piper calls with the news while I'm in hair and makeup for Scrubs. It's nothing glamorous. A guest star is a college student who comes down with shingles, but the exposure is good, and it's another line for my resume. Since the OC, the work has been steady, though not swift. Nothing so lucrative and assuring that I've wanted to quit P.F. Chang's. Well, I always want to quit P.F. Chang's, but I still take a shift now and then, and I still stop in on Thursdays to keep Mariana company, or sometimes jump in for her hours if she has an audition of her own or a gig that's come up. None of the customers recognize me. No one thinks I'm anything to double-take at. I'm not. Half the waiters have booked guest spots of their own, or have made it all the way to testing for pilots. At Tisch, I was something special. In L.A., I'm a slash. A bartender slash actress. I have an audition next week, a period piece called On the Highlands that would shoot later in the year in Scotland. That would launch me out of the slash category, propel me into the full-time actor mode, but I've stopped pinning all my aspirations on every audition. There are too many no's to get invested each time. Pipes, I say into my cell, holding it an inch from my cheek so I don't mess up the shingles makeup that took 2 hours to perfect at 6 o'clock this morning. Not the best time. I can tell that something's awry before she even speaks. Maybe it's in the way she inhales, or the way that she hiccups, or just the way that sisters who have been through so much together can intuit one another, even when thousands of miles apart. Piper, I say, what's wrong? I know you don't want to hear about this, she says, her voice breaking, then dropping into a whisper. But I don't know who else to call. You call me, I say. You can tell me anything. I forget about the painstaking makeup and press the phone to my ear, like that somehow brings us closer. It's Dad. I already know, once she has said this, why I was the one she didn't want to call. Other children might worry about car accidents or heart attacks or some sort of unfortunate accident befalling their solitary living parent, but not me, not us. We've lived through this too many times. What did he do? I ask. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to pick up more pieces. I want a mother who is alive and a father who is sober, and if I had to swap one for the other, my mom should be here, not him. It's a horrible thought. I stare into the illuminated mirror in the makeup trailer and actually think this. That is a horrible thought, but it's true, and it's not like I haven't thought it before. When she was going through chemo and he coped with whiskey, it should be you, not her. When we buried her and he showed up at our childhood home's door, sober but not exactly put together, why her, not you? And now again. Scooter found him passed out on the side of the road last night, held him for the night, called me this morning when Dad had woken up. Scooter Smith was Piper's high school boyfriend. They'd split just before college. She'd gone to Ohio University, and he headed to Wisconsin for football, but they were still friendly, the types who sometimes had a beer together if they'd run into each other earlier in the day, sometimes slept with each other if one beer turned into four. He was a deputy sheriff, thought about being mayor someday, which you'd really never, ever expect if you'd known him back in high school. Still kind of didn't expect now. But I was sitting in a makeup chair playing a college junior with shingles, so what did I know? Bail, I said. Do you need bail money? Tatum, she snaps. No, Scooter let him out, but I mean, we need to get him help. Again, we need to get him help again, I say, just as a production assistant hustles into the trailer and barks, Tatum Connolly, you're up in 5. Tatum Connolly, 5 minutes. Don't say again like we've had to do this a million times. Piper says. How many times, then? I nod to the PA and mouth, wrapping this up, and he answers me by marching out and slamming the door. 3, she sighs. Okay, 3 times. Does that make you happy? Of course it doesn't make me happy, Piper. Well, it doesn't make me happy either, but you're out there in fancy Los Angeles. I'm here sitting in the shit trying to clean it up, so please stop giving me a hard time and help. Fine. How can I help? I say, kinder now. Is it money? I don't really have any money, but Ben has plenty, and what's his is mine, theoretically. We didn't sign a prenup. He didn't even mention a prenup, and he takes care of me in the ways he expects a husband to provide for his wife. But I still haven't quite adjusted to having a safety net, thus the Thursday shifts at the bar. Also, the modest checking account I opened shortly after I landed the OC gig last year, splitting my paycheck between our savings and, well, now my savings. Ben wouldn't have cared if I'd told him, but I didn't. I'd planned to, the night that I went to the bank, and now I can't even remember why I didn't. Maybe I'd fallen asleep while he was working late, or maybe he'd done something that irritated me, or maybe I'd just wanted something for myself when my husband seemingly had everything else. Either way, my checking account won't fund my dad's rehab. But Ben could. Ben would. Happily. Not money, Piper says. Well, I mean, maybe some money. But I want him at an inpatient facility. No more do-it-yourself patchwork sobriety. Do-it-yourself patchwork sobriety was my dad's specialty. I'll ask around, Pipes, okay? The makeup artist's walkie springs to life. I'm needed on set. Why don't you come home? Piper asks, her voice shaking. I can't just come home. Because you're a big, important person now? Hardly, but I'm working, and we adopted the dog, and Ben is out of town half the time, and Monster weighs 100 pounds, and it isn't exactly well-trained, and I can't just take him on the plane with me. The makeup artist says, Tatum, they're ready for you. Also, there is nothing I'd rather do less than go home. Home is cobwebs, and ghosts, and memories of my mother, who should be here. Home is discomfort and high school awkwardness and working at the pharmacy or at Albertson's while other girls were cheerleaders and going to homecoming dances. Home is my dad drinking a case of Coors Light in one sitting and us tiptoeing in the kitchen the mornings of his hangovers so we don't wake him and have to smell his puke. Home is our back garden, which my mom nurtured once my dad left but now holds her ashes. So even that had turned to literal dust. I'd do just about anything other than return home. "Bring him here, Piper," I say rashly, without thinking it through, my mind already on the set, on to nailing the role so I'll get something better, something bigger, something that will take me further from who I used to be. "Just get on a plane and bring him here. We'll figure it out together." We drive him down to a 30-day dryout clinic that weekend. Ben has made some calls, asked for favors, and we found him a bed at Commitments, a no-nonsense facility whose motto is, commit to yourself, commit to life, commit to your sobriety. Piper and my dad sit in the back. Ben drives with his knuckles turning white against the steering wheel, and I stare out the window at the rush of palm trees and desert that whips by.
"You won't have to do this again,"
my dad says as we flank him in the lobby, as a kind nurse with huge fake breasts and adhesive eyelashes pats him on the shoulder and prepares to walk him to his room. I chew on my lip and say nothing.
"I know I have failed you," he says, crying now. "It's not like I don't know it. It's not like I'm not ashamed."
Piper hugs him.
"We're all fallible, Dad. It's okay."
I want to scream, we are not all fallible, not in the ways that he is, but I do not. He says,
"I just miss her so much, your mom, and I shouldn't have found the answer in the bottle. I know that. I'm stupid. It was stupid. I hate myself."
Piper takes his hand.
"We'll get you through this, Dad. I'm sure you can stay here as long as you need. Can he take your guest room after?"
"Our guest room?" I repeat. We hadn't discussed plans after this, but this certainly was not part of it. No, my dad would return home with Piper, get back to work, get back to his own life. But I can't say this now, as we're checking him in to dry out. I can't set him up for failure before he's even started.
"We'll see. Okay, let's just see." "It would help him recalibrate, get away from his triggers," she says.
I said we'll see. She nods. Ben narrows his eyes, starts to say something, then does not. It occurs to me that it's his guest room, too, that he'll want to say. But Ben is always benevolent. Of course he'll offer for him to stay. The nice nurse with enormous breasts says,
"Okay, well, family is welcome next weekend in 7 days. If you head to the desk around the corner, they'll give you all the information."
And then she nods to my father, who is so defeated and looks so much like a broken little child, and ushers him through the swinging door, which eases back into the frame and latches. Piper starts crying, and I stand there, my hands flanking my hips, my brain drifting to all the ways I want this moment to be different, like I'm in a movie and writing my own script, like I'm a daughter with a mom who is alive and a daughter with a father who hasn't been a terrible disappointment. In my mind, in my new role, I'm anyone I want to be, anyone I dare to dream. "Let's go," I say, unable to stand there a second longer in the muddle of the real moment. "Please, can we just get out of here?" I spin quickly and head for the exit. They linger for a moment before following, because they are better equipped for this reality. They don't need to write themselves into a world of make-believe to get by.
15. Ben. June 2009. The doorbell rings early. Too early. The sun has barely risen, and I can't imagine who could possibly be at the front door before 7 a.m. I roll to my left, but Tatum's side of the bed is empty. She must have gotten up for a crack of dawn run on the beach. She's been doing that lately to lean down to ensure that she fits back into the corsets for As You Like It, after gaining 15 pounds, all muscle, for army women. A break from the awards bait films in an attempt to go commercial and expand her fan base. The doorbell rings again. Shit, This had better be an emergency. And whoever it is, it better not wake the baby. I pushed myself to my elbows, then flopped my feet to the carpet. Then I remember the last real emergency from 8 years ago, when my dad, when 3,000 people, died, and chide myself forever wishing for something so stupid. The best you can hope for is that there's never an emergency again, you dumb fuck. I haven't slept well, and the left side of my neck aches. I woke at 3:30, as I do most nights, now worrying about Alcatraz's dismal ratings. How Eric and I had spent the better part of 2 years committed to this TV project. How after its hot start, it's become creatively wretched. You can only have so many shankings before the audience yells, "Jump the shark." And how I didn't even want to do network TV in the first place, and how even that is going south. My dad used to say that if you aim for the middle, you shouldn't expect to come out on top. When I came home with a B in English sophomore year, when I told him I was content on the JV squash squad, when I announced that I didn't care if I were named editor of the school paper, as long as I got to write. He'd push his glasses up on his nose, sip his scotch in his library amid biographies of great men throughout history, Washington and Churchill and Babe Ruth, and eventually plenty of Reagan biographies, too. Reagan was only a few years out of office when I was in high school, and remind me that I'd get lost in the middle, that my potential would seep out of me like water through a drain. Shortly after our trip to Paris for his 40th, my dad was hospitalized for what they thought was an early heart attack. He'd been in court that day, and seized, then fainted. Leo and I were pulled early from school by our nanny, and a waiting town car raced us to Mount Sinai Hospital, a straight shot up Madison Avenue. My mother was there, hysterical, though the nurses were trying to calm her. I remember trying to make myself as still as possible in the waiting room. Our nanny had taken Leo to the cafeteria for a snack, and my mom was still weeping, and there was nothing to be done other than wait. And to still myself, like a superstition, if I could hold myself as if I weren't breathing, prove to God that I could do it, maybe he would save my dad. I never lasted very long. I count to 40 in my head, maybe 45, and then I'd fidget or get distracted by the nurse's station. Finally, I heard my dad in my brain telling me that if I was going to do something, I'd better do it right. So I did. I stared at the floor and held myself still until I reached 637. And just as I was at 638, a doctor emerged and said, "It was a cardiac incident, not a full-blown attack. He's going to be okay." And I exhaled and felt something come unpinned inside of me. Something crazy. Something that thought, maybe I just had to prove to him that I could do it right, and he felt that and came back to us. Now, so many years later, I can see this as literal wishful thinking, but at 15 it felt almost prophetic. That I could be named editor of the paper and be granted a seat at the chessboard with my dad. That I could win an Oscar and, like a piece on a chessboard, move closer to my father, the king. And even if I resented it back then, even if it rankled me, I understood it as I got older. I admire it now, in fact. That if you aspire for mediocrity, that's what you will get. But if you hold your breath for the world record, you'll get your name written up in a book. Alcatraz is mediocrity. And not even good mediocrity at that. So I lie awake every night staring at the ceiling, wrapped in my embarrassment and disappointment. That Tatum is coasting toward the stars doesn't help alleviate my shame of knowing that I have settled. That's not her fault. Of course it's not. But it does shine a mirror on my own inadequacy when what I'd like to do is look away. The doorbell clangs. I wipe the sleep out of my eyes and pad down the hall in my underwear. I stick my head into Joey's room, watch his chest rise and fall for a beat. Tatum's been doing breakfast so I can sleep late before she heads to the set. Joe murmurs something in his sleep, then falls quiet. A small victory. "I'm coming," I whisper to the door. "I'm coming." The doorbell chimes again. "Jesus, I'm coming," I call louder. "It's me," I hear from the outside. I click the latch, swing the door open wide. "Jesus Christ," I say, my hand covering my mouth instinctively. He is wan and disheveled and appears to have puke on his dirty jeans. It's Leo. He sees me, and he starts to cry. He tells me the drugs started out just for fun.
Those lines in Toronto, remember?
I shake my head.
No. When I met you at the film festival, that was the first time. That coke, that party the first night.
I remember then. I flew him up to meet me. I wanted to watch out for him, said I would watch out for him. I'd do better, be better, with my dad gone. Leo drops his head into his hands, then folds himself atop the kitchen table. I brew some black coffee, pour us both too much, and it spills on the counter, where I leave the mess and hand him a mug. I do the math. I don't understand. This has been going on... You've been using for 6 years?
Where have I been? How did I miss this?
I called you once, he says, his eyes filling again. A few years back, I think you were in Dallas, on a shoot, that Kennedy thing. I don't know. Anyway, I called you to tell you that I thought I needed help, but then I lost my nerve. Thought I could do it on my own. Then, I mean, obviously this nightclub investment thing was not the best move.
Nightclub thing?
I invested, remember? I shake my head. It sounds familiar, but I often only hear Leo through a tunnel. I pay close enough attention to ensure that he's checking off the boxes, then tune out the rest of the clatter because there is so much clatter. Everywhere he goes, there is noise. Tatum would probably say I do much the same with her. He sighs.
I went in with some buddies on a place in Miami. Disposable income isn't my problem. Thought I could invest it and have fun at the same time.
I nod. I have no recollection of a nightclub in Miami. I chastise myself. So, you've tried to stop? He shrugs, something small and pathetic, which is to say no. He really hasn't tried all that hard to stop. Even though one look at him, dirty, disheveled, bruises beneath his eyes, cracks along the edges of his lips, informs us both that he is teetering on the edge, close enough to stumble off it and maybe never come back. He tells me that he hasn't slept in 3 nights, that he was downtown partying and a girl he was with OD'd, that he knew if he didn't get on a plane and tell me now in person, ask for help, he'd be next. So you haven't tried to stop. I hear my voice, the judgment. I hate myself for it, but it's there all the same. Tatum hears this all the time with Walter. This is the first time I've really heard it for myself.
It could have been me, Ben. Shit. It could have been me.
Have you told the people at work? Because if you haven't, then you shouldn't. They can fire you. He slaps both palms against the table.
This isn't fucking about work, Ben.
It's not. I know. I sit beside him, rest both of my hands on his knees. I have to do better at this. If Tatum were here, she'd be better. I try to intuit what she'd say. I just meant... Look, we've been through this with Walter, Tatum's dad. We'll get through it, but you'll need the month. 30 days to get straight. He nods.
I'm their best trader. They'll give it to me.
He pauses.
Ironic, isn't it? How could I admit something I hate?
He loathes me when he says this. I know it. I can feel it cutting through my soul. As if the words are fingers pointing at me and saying, you made me stick with it. You tried to be my father when I just needed a brother. I just tried to do what I thought was right, I say, sliding my hands back into my own lap. I thought it was time for you to be a grown-up.
Whoever gave you the right to tell me how to be a grown-up?
Dad did, I say, and regret it immediately.
You're not Dad,
he says, intuiting my thoughts. He rises and heads toward the bathroom. I hear him vomiting for a good 5 minutes. And I know I should go in there, rub his back, offer some comfort. But I find that I am unable to. Unable to stand and do what's best for him, when what's best for me is to stay here, stuck in my chair, without having to confront the reality of all the ways I have failed him. Tatum handles all the things that I cannot. Her tank top is still sweat-pocked, her cheeks still pink, by the time she has called commitments, spoken to the staff as if they are old friends, secured Leo a bed. She phones her agent, tells her she'll make it to set that day. She's a pro, after all. but will be leaving immediately after the crew breaks for the union-mandated lunch. She often lingers around to shadow the director, to play scenes with her co-stars off-camera. A benevolence the pros afford their peers when they all get along.
Family emergency, she says to Jocelyn, her agent. I'll tell them when I get there, but FYI, this comes first for me today. In case you get any gripes, or whatever, in case anyone calls me a bitch to TMZ.
Only recently has the tabloid industry started to take interest in Tatum. Every once in a while, I'll be in the checkout line at CVS and catch a small snippet about a usually made-up bit in Us Weekly. Or I'll lose myself to the internet by Googling her name when I should be writing, only to find a handful of stories about on-set behavior or romances, which surely aren't true. Tatum pays them little mind. Sometimes they'll print a quick bit about her rivalry with Lily Marple, and she'll scan the copy and mutter something like, God, she's such a bitch. That one they get right.
I'm only doing one shot today,
she says 15 minutes after hanging up with Jocelyn, bounding down the steps, wrapping her just-showered hair into a bun. She's gotten more beautiful as she's gotten more famous. And it's not that her beauty is tied to her fame. Rather, she's grown more confident, more comfortable in her skin. Like she's finally living her best life. I was watching Oprah recently and heard that phrase, in case you're wondering.
I'll be home just after noon. We'll head down then. I called my dad to come by in the meantime.
I steal my jaw. She notices.
Don't even start with me, she says, throwing her script and phone into her bag. He's been through it. He'll help.
Joey starts to wail from his room.
Shit, she says. Jocelyn is asking them to push everything up for me today. Can you handle breakfast?
I nod.
It's not like I want to miss his breakfast, she snaps. It's my favorite part of my day.
I didn't say that you wanted to. She sighs.
Constance will be here in 30 minutes. If you don't want to do breakfast, she'll handle it.
The truth is that Joey doesn't like me feeding him. He greedily laps up whatever Tatum and Constance, our nanny, put in front of him. But with me, no, it's on the floor or against the wall or sometimes in his mouth, then dribbled right out. Tatum says it's because he can sense that he's pushing my buttons, so he keeps going. I suspect that she knows a thing or two about this because she does the same thing. It's not that we want to fight or snip at each other, but we find ourselves doing so more often now. She's working too much. I'm working on something I have no interest in, Alcatraz, and which is doing poorly anyway. Neither of us is sleeping in the way that you need to not to take a small injustice and spiral it into something that suddenly feels like you'd stake your life on it. Also, of course, there's her father. How forgiving she has been of him, how unforgiving I have been. That he is alive and has abused so many of his years here is too much for me to ignore, even if he has rehabilitated himself, even if he is now clear-headed and present. I recognize that this is petty and also small-minded. Addiction is not a character flaw you hold against someone forever. And yet, I do. Fair or not, rational or not. He is here and has been given so many second chances, and my father had been given none. I'll do breakfast, I say. It's not a problem. Maybe he'll finally agree to eat on my watch. I make a face that signals, no way in hell will that happen. And it's meant to make her laugh, but she misses it as her phone buzzes in her bag, and then she runs to the town car the studio sends each morning.
Yes, yes, thanks, Dad. I'll be back in a few hours. He's here. I'm sure that would be great.
She is sending Walter, knowing how much it will annoy me, knowing that she didn't even ask me if I'll mind. She's been doing that more often now, making executive decisions, both big and small, without asking. Usually I don't mind. Today I do. The door shuts behind her and the house is quiet once more. Leo is sleeping out back in the guest house. So I plod up the stairs to retrieve my crying son, who will fight me over his oatmeal because he can sense that I'm weak. Survival of the fittest. Human instinct. Walter rings the doorbell right as I open my laptop. Of course I can't work today, can't focus. And besides, Eric is overseeing this week's script, which may be our last as we await our inevitable cancellation. But I'd promised myself that I'd revisit Reagan, figure out what exactly I could tweak to lure Spencer back into shopping it around, to to re-engage the studios, get me back into the good graces of the film world, not the shitty network TV world. In the doorway, Walter shakes my hand, because we're not the type to hug. "We'll get him through this," he says, as if I've asked or said anything contrary. I check my watch. Tatum will still be gone for a few hours. "I just have to make a quick call," I say, before ducking